Welcome to Tech Tuesday from All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Over the 4th of July, a record-breaking storm blew through Texas, flooding the Guadalupe River. More than 120 people were killed. Thousands of Texans have been displaced. Almost as volatile as the storm itself, we've seen many different opinions about the storm and the response. Some are calling it a huge conspiracy event, while others are calling it the results of mass cuts from the federal government. Where are we with the nation's weather technology, and what conspiracy theories have spread across the country? Joining us now is Molly Taft, a senior science writer at Wired. Welcome to the show, Molly.
Thanks so much for having me.
So starting us off, was there a disconnect between the National Weather Service and what happened in Texas, or was this a once-in-a-lifetime storm?
It's a great question. When the news first broke about what happened in Texas, I think a lot of people rightly recalled a lot of the really bad signs we've seen about what DOGE cuts are doing to the National Weather Service. You know, meteorologists have been sounding the alarm about the mass layoffs at NOAA, which is the parent agency of the NWS. I think at last count, some 600 meteorologists are no longer with the agency. There are weather stations that can no longer staff 24/7. Weather balloons are not going up as scheduled because of cost cuts. Like, it's pretty dire at the agency. So it was a initial question about how much of a role the NWS actually played in this forecast. But meteorologists overwhelmingly have said that no, the agency was actually really on top of forecasting this storm. About a week before, Tropical Storm Barry made landfall in Mexico, which is, when you have a tropical storm, that's kind of a recipe for pumping some moisture northward. The NWS was pretty on top of forecasting downpours, heavy rains later on in the week, throughout the first part of that week. You know, I've seen even meteorologists, casual meteorologists on message boards saying, guys, actually, this data is actually pretty concerning. Like, looks like it could be a big storm in Texas. And importantly, you know, we do see there's a lot of concern about weather balloons. A weather balloon did go up as scheduled on Thursday and provided some really valuable data. So, you know, the NWS was on in forecasting this storm. And I think it's also really important to note that forecasting the amount of rain that's going to fall with an event like this is really tough. There's a lot of elements that go into just how much rain happens in an event like this. And, you know, meteorologists say, like, even with the best available predictive tools, there is still some element of question when you see a heavy storm. But it is incontrovertible that by, you know, the evening of Thursday, the worst of the storms happened, like, early Friday morning, and NWS was issuing increasingly dire warnings. And the real question is what the response was to that warning.
I wanted to talk about the technology for a minute because the technology the National Weather Service uses, you mentioned weather balloons a couple of times, and I smiled at the idea of a weather balloon because in this day and age, you would think that there would be something more scientific than sending a balloon up in the air. But is that truly the best way to figure things out?
It's still a really reliable technology. We need to get up there. We need to sense what's happening. You can send a balloon up and it will gather data about what's actually going on, you know, record precipitation data. And, you know, even I think that there's sort of a craze to incorporate, you know, AI into weather predictive technologies. But, like, often the best thing you can do is have infrastructure to record what's actually happening in the weather. And, you know, we have some of the best, you know, public weather information available with the NWS. So yeah, weather balloons are still a really, really valuable part of this service.
Now, as you mentioned, the National Weather Service, Thursday leading into Friday, did issue watches, then warnings, then issued an emergency. But it seems like some of those messages did not get to people in time. They didn't, like, the National Weather Service can say it all day long, but if the people don't hear the message, then, you know, it doesn't help them. So was that a staffing issue? Was it related to the time of night that this all was happening, where if you issue an emergency at 4 a.m, who hears it?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And honestly, I think that's going to be the big question from the fallout of the, frankly, this tragedy is what exactly happened here. There's a couple things to think about. As you said, the NWS can issue all the warnings they want, but if local emergency managers are not picking up on those warnings and getting them out to citizens, then there's no good in having a warning no one hears, right? Parts of the areas in Texas that were impacted are extremely rural. Usually you would have something, if you were camping without cell service, you would have something called a weather radio that can plug directly into NWS alerts. It's not clear who had those, who didn't have those. The local emergency management was reliant on a text-based system, and there's questions about why the NWS warnings may or may not have gone out in time on the text-based system. There's also questions of, like, I'm sure you get a lot of warnings on your phone. We all get a lot of notifications on our phone these days. There are really outstanding questions about how we warn people about serious events, especially in Texas, where this area floods are really, really common. And then there's a larger conversation about how well the county was prepared. You know, there's been a lot of reporting on this county had tried to get money to upgrade its warning system to implement sirens, potentially sirens, to alert people who didn't have a phone or didn't have a weather radio that something was happening, to upgrade the text system with a more automated system. They applied for some FEMA money. They didn't get it. When they got some more federal money, they didn't install it. So this is a chain of really, it's kind of like the worst possible situation. And then, you know, there's also reporting about building out in a floodplain. You know, the Times had a good report on the location of some buildings in that girls' camp was just right on the floodplain. And you know, if you build in an area that is really, really susceptible, you are going to have to be either really, really on top of your warnings or potentially not build in that area. So there is, like you said, the warnings are just the first step, right? It's then implementing those warnings, and there seems to have been a lot of factors in this case that really coalesced to the kind of worst case scenario.
Well, and I'm sure everyone listening, I mean, here in Central Ohio, we have tornado sirens outside, but then we also get, if there's a tornado warning, your cell phone provider sends you a warning. But we can all be guilty of, especially if it's in the middle of the night, not moving quick very fast, right? You look at it and you're like, oh, really? Then you look outside, then you're like, you know,
Well,
So.
like I in New York, you know, we I got a weather alert on my phone yesterday that heavy rains were coming, and I was like, whatever, I have things to do. But I woke up this morning to videos of subways getting flooded, and it was really intense in some areas. And it's hard to gauge by yourself what the appropriate response is.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the Texas floods with Molly Taft, a senior science writer at Wired. So a phenomenon that you reported on is the reaction of many Texans and the broader American public about some conspiracy theories surrounding this event. You wrote a story about some of the conspiracy theories. Can you explain what some people are saying about the flood? I mean, they're saying that this weather event was created and deployed like a weapon. Is that even possible?
Yeah, it's not, to be very clear, up at the top. So there were a couple of things that sort of coalesced around the public response to this. There has been a community that has been building in power over the past couple of years, as we're seeing increasingly a distrust in science, you know, folks peddling conspiracy theories getting to the highest level of our government. There are people who believe that the government is currently engaged in weather manipulation. There's a variety of different beliefs on this, from, you know, there's tech meant to combat global warming that is changing our planet, to, you know, the government is deploying a weapon against its own citizens, kind of wide variety of beliefs. But the basic idea is that there is human intervention in the weather. So after this storm, which was so intense, partially juiced up by climate change, probably, there were a lot of these conspiracy theories that had been already brewing really bubbled to the surface. One thing that I think helped the spread of these theories is that there was a cloud seeding operation in Texas. It's from a pretty buzzy startup called Rainmaker. The founder is a young Peter Thiel fellow who has been photographed with Bill Clinton, which, like, did not help some of these conspiracy theories online. And his company does something called cloud seeding, which has been in use for decades across the country. It's basically inserting some material into a cloud to make it rain more, essentially. And that does sound, if you are not, you know, well informed about that technology, that does sound super suspicious. he had an operation about 120 miles away from the eye of the storm a couple days before. And with the weather report, he stopped those operations per Texas regulations. Texas has regulations on cloud seeding and other geoengineering technologies. But I think that what's important is, I think I asked like three meteorologists, like, is there any chance that cloud seeding could have? And they basically all just like laughed at me. They were like, there's absolutely no chance that this technology contributed in any way. Cloud seeding is used to juice up precipitation from existing clouds. It cannot create like a whole, like a storm out of whole cloth. But, because that online community had already been talking about, weather as a weapon, it really, really took off. And, there have been several states recently that have heard legislation to ban cloud seeding and other types of geoengineering. And Florida actually did ban it earlier this year. So after that, after the storms, Marjorie Taylor Greene has said that she's going to introduce legislation based on this Florida legislation. So it's a conspiracy theory that all of a sudden seems to have legs and is being juiced up by these extreme weather events we're seeing.
Some of the conspiracy theories you reported on, including the cloud seeding and then some others, have been shared millions of times on social media. Do we know if companies like X or Instagram are boosting these posts, or are they really that popular?
We don't know for sure, but I think that it's not an uneducated guess to assume, based on how we see algorithms working, that that these posts took off for a reason. Look, we've seen social media companies like Meta, especially like X, move away from this idea of content moderation. They used to, a couple of years ago, they were taking seriously the idea that they had to be responsible for content, but many of these big companies have since moved away from fact-checking posts or, to asking people to take down posts that have conspiracy theories at the heart of them. And they've really allowed conspiracy theories like this to flourish on social media. And I think we're only probably going to be seeing more of this. It's interesting. The EPA, a couple days after the storm, said we're releasing some resources on geoengineering. We're responding to you. And if you go to the EPA website, to its credit, it is very scientifically accurate. They had a lot of really good resources on some commonly asked questions about geoengineering. But there is this push-pull about appeasing folks who are afraid of things, who are sort of ginning up the crowd on social media versus providing scientifically accurate information that I think we're definitely going to see a lot more of.
And then Marjorie Taylor Greene, who is a U.S. representative, she introduced a bill that she said, quote, to end the dangerous and deadly practice of weather modification and geoengineering. So your story says, that Greene once blamed California wildfires on laser beams. There's a lot out there about that. But doesn't having a U.S. representative talk about this give it a little more weight than just a random conspiracy theory on X or Instagram?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think this isn't the only conspiracy theory in recent years that we've seen be adopted by someone at a very high level of government. I think what's going to be interesting about geoengineering is that, cloud seeding especially has pretty widespread support among farmers. Clients of cloud seeding companies are local water boards, like, rural areas that need more rain. And this is a pretty tested method of doing it. So I think with legislation at the national level, it's going to be a question of, misinformation versus like what's actually going on scientifically here. But yeah, I definitely think it's a level of recognition of this idea that the government controls the weather that is concerning, to say the least.
And I like the way you describe it in your story about cloud seeding, where someone that you interviewed described it as cloud seeding is like adding icing to a cake. So you're able to juice up precipitation from an already existing cloud to help out a drier area, but you're not going to bake the cake entirely. Is that the right metaphor?
Yeah, it's a tool. It's not something that, as it has been practiced, for decades, and as it stands now, is going to create this like awful storm that could be used against citizens. What I also, personally, as someone who's reported on climate change for years, I find a certain irony in the fact that like a lot of the storms we are seeing are so intense because of climate change, which of course is caused by human use of fossil fuels over decades. So, I understand why people think a lot of these storms are unnatural, because we have helped juice them up. Like we have helped create, make them more intense. It's just, I think locating the source of that surprise and outrage at how our own weather seems to be turning against us is a challenging proposition in the age of disinformation on social media.
I want to say thank you to Molly Taft, senior science writer at Wired. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And coming up, we're going to talk about Black Twitter and television. That's when Tech Tuesday continues from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
Summer is here. Join WOSU at family-friendly community events and festivals all summer long. For all dates and locations, visit our events page, wosu.org/events.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Since the beginning of massively popular TV shows, they've always been a reflection of society and trends around them. From Friends in the 90s to MASH in the 70s, they are snapshots and reactions to a changing society. This continued with shows in the 2000s, but also added to the equation was social media. Black Twitter and the massive rise of social media has led to a revolution in how shows are made, who they're made for, and how showrunners interact with their audience. Joining me now is Sherry Williams, an associate professor of race, media, and communications at American University and author of Black Social Television, How Black Twitter Changed Television. Welcome to the show, Sherry.
Thank you, Amy.
So you are also a former Columbus Dispatch reporter, and you used to call Columbus home. So I want to also say welcome back to Columbus.
I did. Thank you. And it is so great to be back here. I love this city. I miss it a lot.
So what drew you to the topic of Black Twitter and its intersection with television?
Honestly, after I left the Dispatch, I went to graduate school at Syracuse University's Newhouse School. And while I was doing my homework on Sundays, like on high school, you know, when you watch TV and do your homework at the same time,
of course,
even though
yeah.
you probably shouldn't. So I'd watch television. And while I was watching television, The Real Housewives of Atlanta, I also noticed that the things that the women said, the things they did, street names, their catchphrases and sayings, just so many things would end up trending on Twitter. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it would be like one or two things, but one night when they took over all 10 trending topics, that's when I knew something was there. And also on Monday nights, when all these other shows on VH1 come on that have primarily Black casts on the reality mm-hmm. shows, like Black Basketball Wives and Love and Hip Hop, the same thing would happen. So my research partner at the time, Lanessa Williams, and I would just start making a note of these things. It ended up becoming my dissertation, and now it's a book.
Okay, so I suppose we should back up and explain what we mean by Black Twitter. What does that term mean as opposed to regular old Twitter?
So Black Twitter is basically just this connected network of Black people who are communicating in a very authentic way within a cultural context. It's not like there's a different app or anything like that. There's no secret password or anything like that. It is really just the unique way that we are engaging on the platform, or that we have really, especially before Elon Musk took it over. So that's basically what it is. It's just the way that Black people are connected and really address not only social issues, but also representation issues. And I think that's really important because when we think about how Black people have been represented in media, particularly news media and entertainment media, there have been a lot of distortions, a lot of mischaracterization, and Black Twitter has been a space where we can communicate authentically and also do some media literacy and some media critique in real time.
And we'll get to Elon Musk changing Twitter in a minute, but is there historical evidence or some context of why television and TV shows work so well with this idea of Black Twitter? Why didn't it work for other like marketing campaigns or a movie or something like that? Why TV?
I think because one thing that I talk about in the book is that we always watch television together. You know, whether you think about Super Bowl parties or people get together and watch Star Wars together every May, you know, people always watch together. And that is really important. But what this has been able to do is really have, we can have these connected conversations, but you don't have to be in the same room. You don't have to be in the same location with someone. And especially when we think about our representations, being able to speak back to Hollywood to say, this, thank you for this. This is something that is authentic, that we do care about, or this is something that is a real distortion of our images and does not really reflect our humanity and leans into stereotypes. So we've been able to come together and watch and also speak back to the people who have the power to circulate these images.
Now, is this something that was unique to working on Twitter, or could it have worked on something like Instagram or Facebook?
It was really unique to Twitter. And in the book, really, my book is, I know I tend to think of this as historic, but also old history at the same time, especially when you think about technology, you know, things go really fast. So mm-hmm. I'm really talking about what I see as like the golden age of Twitter. And that's basically from maybe around 2012 to maybe 2019, mm-hmm. when people were really engaged in this process a lot back then. And I think about Scandal, how people would rush home and, you know, try not to look at Twitter because they didn't want to, you know, engage in the spoilers. Or it actually revived appointment television because people wanted to see what people were saying about it. Mm-hmm. And also they wanted to see, you know, what was happening on the TV screen at the same time. But Facebook really didn't have that same capability because you only saw the post from your friends, people within your network, people who you know. But if you're looking at the Scandal hashtag on Twitter, you see comments from everyone. So it's just really the way that Twitter was set up and the technological affordances that it had made it really a special place for social engagement around television.
Now, you just mentioned the TV show Scandal. Earlier, you said Real Housewives of Atlanta. What was the very first TV show you saw this in?
You mean this kind of engagement around television? Mm-hmm. Honestly, 106 and Park.
Okay.
106 and Park. If people don't know, 106 and Park.
Yeah, I
know
you got me. I don't know what that is.
Okay. Well, I know you remember American Bandstand with
yes.
Dick Clark, right?
Yeah.
So this 106 and Park was basically kind of like the hip hop and R&B version of that in the 90s and the early 2000s. And during that era, specifically in the early 2000s, 106 and Park, as early as that time, was saying, hey, you know, this is our top 10. Our top 10 videos are coming up right now. Which one is the one that you like the best? You know, tweet us, use this hashtag. They had like, honestly, they had probably too many hashtags, too many to follow. But they, for one thing, they knew that they had a young audience that watched a lot of television, listened to the current music, and also was over-indexed on Twitter. And so they actually started taking advantage of that first. That was when I first started to see a network or a show really engage with its audience online.
Joining me now is Sherry Williams, a race and representation researcher at American University and author of the book Black Social Television, How Black Twitter Changed Television. This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. Can you talk about the role Black women specifically have played in terms of this digital activism? Have women played more of a role than men, do you think?
I think so, because what I think is really important is something that Moya Bailey, a scholar, developed, and it's this concept called misogynoir. And so basically what she talks about is anti-Black misogyny that Black women experience in the United States, but particularly through visual and digital culture. And so what she's talking about is television, film, and also on social media. Because particularly in the early days in social media, a lot of what we saw that was trending, that people thought was funny, were a lot of stereotypes and a lot of different distortions about Black women in particular, like things Black girls say or what things Black girls do and all these kinds of things that were really leaning into some ugly gender and racial stereotypes. But she also talks about this concept called digital alchemy, where women of color, Black women, non-binary, gender variant people take everyday media that already exists and they recode it and shift it to create social justice media. So a lot of these campaigns that have happened on social media in defense of Black images have been spearheaded by Black women.
So part of what you write about is the more modern landscape of entertainment. How do you feel COVID-19 impacted this Black social television trend? Because it took people, COVID-19 changed the way, you know, we engage with media. Mm-hmm. And people, just talk about that. How did COVID-19 change the trend?
One thing that I saw is that typically, when I think about social television and Black social television in particular, mm-hmm. there is the main screen. The television screen is the main screen. And the mobile technology, whether it's a phone or a tablet or a laptop, is the second screen.
Yeah, everyone has two screens at the same time now.
Right,
yeah.
Right. But mm-hmm. during the pandemic, Black creators were using social media as the main screen. Mm-hmm. And using social media to actually create programming. Because this was a time where, you know, we really could not be around each other. So how do we create community? How do we find a way to feel unified together? And they did that through Versus, for example. And that was when Swiss Beatz and Timbaland, two hip hop producers, got together and, well, you play your best songs, I'll play my best songs, and go head to head. Okay, well, now let's get Brandy together with Monica and they play their best songs. Let's mm-hmm. get, and it was intergenerational. Let's get Earth, Wind, and Fire and the Isley Brothers to do the same thing. Babyface and Teddy Riley. And what was great about that is it gave us as a culture a chance to, and when I say a culture, I really mean an American culture, not just Black culture, to revisit some of the best music in recent history. And it also revived the careers of some of these artists. And Babyface actually ended up starting an album with some of the newer pop girls who are out now called Girls Night Out, and was nominated and won a Grammy for it.
Hmm. Now, we mentioned Elon Musk a little earlier. It's mm-hmm. been almost 3 years since Elon Musk bought Twitter and rebranded it as X. How has the platform changed since then? More importantly, how are Black audiences using the platform now?
There's been a mass exodus of Twitter mm-hmm. because a lot of people just don't want to be associated with or feed into a site that is run by someone who has very problematic and racist values. And we know that a lot of the moderators who were trying to keep Twitter safe back when Jack Dorsey owned it were fired. We know that the use of the N-word and other racial slurs skyrocketed more than 300% immediately after he took over. GLAAD designated Twitter as the most unsafe platform for queer people. So it is a place and a space where hate speech is allowed to thrive. And we already live in a society where hate crimes are up and there is so much polarization and division. So it is a place where people have decided that they just don't want to be anymore. So Twitter doesn't have the same significance, and it doesn't hold the same place that it used to. So Black Twitter doesn't either. But one thing that I think is important about Black Twitter is the connectivity and the momentum and the influence that was there has really just kind of spread out across other platforms.
I was just going to ask, where did everyone go? Did they go to Instagram or did they go to TikTok? Where did they go?
People are all over. They're on Instagram. They're on TikTok. They're also on this app called Spill. Spill was started by Alphonse Terrell, a Black man who was working at Twitter, who was actually fired by Elon Musk immediately after Elon Musk took over. And now he started Spill, which is this platform that really does engage in a lot of social media conversations around entertainment. Alphonse Terrell also used to work in cable television, and he worked at HBO. So he already has like this natural digital television marketing background. So there's a lot of conversations on that app specifically about Black representation and about other things that Black people care about. And it spilled over after this Black colloquialism of spill the tea, as in like talk about juicy gossip.
I got to spill the tea. Okay. So I think now so much has changed with X in the last 3 years. Do you need to write a second book?
No, I'm done. I'm done. I have no interest. I still have an account. It is not active just because I want to at least know what's going on. But no, I'm not interested in taking a long deep dive into Twitter anymore, really just because for my own mental health and safety.
All right. So not another book about that, but you could write another book about where everyone went, right?
Yeah, the exodus of
Black Twitter.
Yeah. I'm actually working on another book right now, but it's really the book that I'm working on right now is about journalism and the need to shift from reporting from a people deficit approach to reporting through a systems deficit approach.
Hmm. Now, can we back up just a little bit more? Can you talk about some of the trends amongst the Black community about what is reflected on television? How did, when Black Twitter was in its heyday, which you said was about 2012 to 2019, is that right? So how, I mean, it's the subtitle of your book, How Black Twitter Changed Television. What did it change? What trends did we see during that 7-year period?
Well, we saw shows get revived, shows get blocked, and shows be brought back to life. I think one really good example is this show called Confederate, which was being developed by the guys who did Game of Thrones. And so Confederate, pardon me, was going to be this show that imagined the United States as if the Confederacy actually won and if slavery were just a corporation, right? Mm. And just an updated version of it. And April Rain, who started Oscars So White, basically said in 2017 when this was announced, we really don't need what Roxane Gay called it, slavery fan fiction. We really don't need to have a show like this where we imagine that white supremacy reigns supreme, because this was also around the time when there was the white supremacists who were marching on the UVA campus with those tiki torches saying, "You will not replace us," and talking about the great replacement theory. This was 2 years after Dylann Roof went into a Black church and killed almost a dozen parishioners during Bible study. Hate crimes were on the rise. So we didn't have to be entertained by white supremacist violence because we were actually living it. So while Game of Thrones was on the air, they used the Game of Thrones hashtag, and because people, like, this social activity didn't just happen with Black shows, it happened with all shows. Mm-hmm. They used the Game of Thrones hashtag and also the No Confederate hashtag, saying that they didn't want the Game of Thrones producers to produce this show, Confederate. It trended for weeks, and that show actually never came to light. Mm-hmm. There was another show called Sorority Sisters that VH1 had, and it was typically the typical framework. You know, these women who were members of Black Greek letter organizations would get together supposedly just to have lunch, but they would end up maybe fighting or throwing, you know, martinis across the table at each other and different things like that. These are organizations that are very respected and have done a lot of community service work. Black people didn't appreciate Greek letter organizations being portrayed this way. So what they did when the show was airing is they tweeted directly at the advertisers. Mm-hmm. So they tweeted to Bose, to CarMax, NBA, Toyota, and said, is this the kind of programming that you think we want about Black women? Because if it is, we're not going to buy your speakers anymore or your cars or your NBA tickets. And that show ended up going off the air. They quietly like played the last 3 episodes at like 3:00 in the morning, and the show never came back. And even though it was running during prime time, those actual official corporate accounts were responding in real time saying, "Hey guys, we're sorry. We will back off, and we don't want to lose your business, but we will definitely be pulling our ads from this show."
Interesting. Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show to tell me about your book. We've been talking with Sherry Williams, an associate professor of race, media, and communications at American University and author of Black Social Television, How Black Twitter Changed Television. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Amy. I appreciate it.
And coming up, we're going to talk about a new smartphone from Samsung, and also Amazon has reached its 1 millionth warehouse robot. What does that mean? Well, we'll have more on Tech Tuesday when it continues from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich, and this is Tech Tuesday, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Samsung is the latest company to release a brand new smartphone, the thin, slick, foldable Galaxy Z Fold Z Fold 7. Sorry, these names are so hard for me. However, some people are questioning if the device is worth the hefty price tag. Joining us now to talk about it is Russell Hawley, the Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Welcome back to All Sides, Russell.
Thank you.
I always mess up the phone names. Okay, so the Galaxy Z Fold 7.
They don't make it easy for you.
No. Can't we just call it Phone A, Phone B? Okay. So why did Samsung design the Fold 7 to be so thin?
Yeah, so Samsung has been working really hard for the last 7 years now on two different foldable phone concepts. The one is what they call a candy bar foldable, which is something that fits really slim in the pocket. It's basically like a square, and when you open it up, it's a thin, long rectangle that has the size of like a normal phone screen. That is the flip line. The fold line takes that basically like a book where the phone opens up and it becomes much, much larger on the inside. So you've got a very large screen to work with. And that serves what Samsung views as two different sets of audiences, right? One is for folks who don't spend a ton of time on their phone and would prefer that it not take up a lot of space in their pocket or purse. And one who would really prefer that their phone replace a laptop or a tablet when they need it to do so. And so when you have a phone like that that lives in your pocket, it being thin really matters, because otherwise you've got a giant rectangular bulge out of the back of one of your pockets, or, you know, it takes up just an enormous amount of space. And because this phone has a separate screen on the front, if you aren't careful, it can be, you know, susceptible to scratches and things like that. So having it be thin means that you can put it in your front pocket and not, you know, feel like you're broadcasting to the world that you have a giant phone in your back, in your front pocket.
Mm. Now, I mentioned that it's expensive. I mean, how hefty of a price tag are we talking here?
The Galaxy Z Fold 7 starts, its least expensive model is $2,000. And that is for the base level storage. You know, there's a lot of hardware that goes into this, you know, so it's obviously going to be more expensive than your average phone that you would see in a store. However, if you decide that you want quite a bit more storage, or, you know, some of the accessories that go into it, it can very quickly, you know, get up to $3,000, you know, and that's before you're talking about adding things like insurance and stuff like that. These are phones that are designed to replace, you know, the time that you would spend on a laptop or a tablet. But it is basically the same cost as having a phone and a tablet with you at all times.
I was just going to say, $3,000 is a lot for something that I drop all the time, because I can't tell you how often I drop my phone and lose my phone, misplace my phone. I don't know.
No, it's actually a really important point that you bring up, because foldable phones as a whole, as a category, are considerably less durable than non-folding phones. You know, your standard iPhone or Samsung phone is going to withstand more drops and be able to handle more things like water ingress and dust and stuff like that than any foldable phone, just because of that crease that gets formed. Samsung in particular has made quite a few changes to this design in particular to try and make that a little easier. But anytime you make something thinner, you make something lighter, the way that the cameras stick out of the back of this phone is quite jarring. You almost have to put a case on it, which kind of makes it not thin anymore, because you now have a bit of plastic wrapped around it. But yeah, I mean, these are, you know, physically, you know, really impressive phones to hold and experience. But if you are the kind of person who regularly drops their phone, you're probably not benefiting from how thin it is.
Is having a foldable phone going to be something everyone has 10 years from now? Will everyone have a foldable phone?
I don't know about everyone. I think that we're probably, you know, reaching this sort of divergent point where, you know, things like curved screens on your wrist are likely the thing that we would see before everyone moves to a phone that folds or, you know, some other, you know, kind of version of that technology. But this very much serves an audience that, you know, has a need for a larger screen in very specific situations. And Samsung's, you know, version of this phone, the Z Fold 7, also connects to their kind of empty shell that they have called DeX. That allows you to expand that technology into an even larger screen. If you occasionally need a laptop, but not all the time, then this is kind of like a dummy that doesn't have any hardware inside of it other than a screen and a keyboard. And it relies on your phone to do all of the, you know, the brain work when you plug it in.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. I wanted to move on to Amazon. Amazon has reached its 1 millionth warehouse robot, calling into question the company's future when it comes to delivery service. So 1 millionth warehouse robot, that sounds ominous to me for some reason. I don't know why. What does it mean to have 1 million robots?
Amazon has more than 300 warehouses across the world right now where it stores things that need to be shipped to, you know, to any country, any place, any time. And they have not been shy over the last decade that they have been trying to replace, you know, some of the really challenging jobs that happen in a warehouse, especially moving heavy boxes and stuff like that. You know, having a robot do that is not only safer, but likely in the long run, less expensive than having a person with a forklift do it. There's also, you know, nowadays, less accident prone when it comes to, you know, finding the right product and you know, getting it in the box. Then, you know, something that has, you know, fallen over or broken, you know, these robots are able to detect, you know, abnormalities, you know, in different ways. But, you know, as far as the ability to actually deliver something outside of the warehouse, Amazon is a little bit behind that, actually, compared to, you know, if you're I can't tell you the last time I've been to the Los Angeles area and not seen, you know, a delivery robot of some kind on the street. Almost all of those are delivered, you know, by humans that are, you know, kind of remotely driving those things. You know, Amazon has not been as successful at deploying things like that in major cities as some of these other companies. So it'd be interesting to see, you know, how that expands, you know, in the coming years.
What's public opinion of Amazon's warehouse robots having some of these jobs? Having robots replace some previously human jobs in a warehouse?
Well, Amazon doesn't have the greatest track record ever of how humans are treated in those warehouses. So I'm sure that Amazon is quite happy that that conversation falls to the wayside when we don't have to worry about whether or not humans are being treated poorly in those conditions. On the other hand, you know, fewer jobs for humans, especially right now, is not exactly a great thing. So I think that there's some mixed opinions there. You know, these robots, in a lot of cases, you know, they don't need to worry about air conditioning the entire warehouse if there aren't people in them. You know, and Amazon is far from the only company that does this. We know that there are candy companies that have warehouses in the UK that are fully autonomous. There are no humans that step in those buildings for months at a time for different things. So, you know, this is, you know, a way that this is going as these warehouses get bigger and bigger, you know, putting humans inside of them is just prohibitively expensive when you're talking about, you know, climate control and things like that.
I made a joke about having 1 million robots, but because it seems like some sort of science fiction movie. But is 1 million robots a lot of robots, or Amazon's such a huge company? I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if they had 10 million robots. I don't know.
1 million robots that do this kind of work and are not, you know, sitting on a shelf doing nothing is definitely impressive when you consider that Amazon's human workforce in total, I think, is around 1.6 million. So it is likely within the next 5 years that Amazon will have more, you know, robots doing that work than humans.
Now I'm picturing one robot for every human. So now it's like a little like buddy comedy. I'm making this into some sort of movie.
That's right.
So, okay. So then talk to me a little bit more about Amazon delivery with robots. Because you said Amazon is behind in this aspect. But is it because Amazon's so huge and delivering so many things to so many places? Is that why they're having trouble with the robot delivery?
I think the biggest reason is Amazon's goal was very different from its competitors in the kind of near term. Amazon, when it talks about using a fleet to deliver things, is talking about flying drones in a lot of cases, being able to get somewhere that is quite difficult for a human being to drive to and make that delivery and have that, you know, be something that that gets done. After Amazon made that announcement, I think 6 years ago, there was quite a bit in the way of government regulation all across the world that slowed that down and made it so that Amazon had to do a little bit of work before it accidentally dropped a laptop on a child, you know, in the middle of a city center or something like that, you know. So there's just a ton of things about that that become complicated. But, you know, Amazon will likely be at the forefront of that once those regulations are sorted out in a way, because they've been doing all of this work in the meantime. You know, for kind of an immediate, you know, local delivery, Amazon has a small robotics fleet for delivering inside of, you know, towns and cities. But it pales in comparison to a lot of the you know, like food delivery companies and things like that that have been doing this for a little while now.
I wanted to move on to our last topic. Starting in California, the popular dating app Tinder will try to combat catfishing by requiring its users to log in with facial recognition. So aside from frequent catfishing on the site, which is basically pretending to be something you're not, what caused this update? Why facial recognition?
You know, there's been a couple of different ways to approach this. This is something that, you know, Tinder has already launched in Canada and Colombia. You know, the goal here to, you know, not just to stop catfishing, but to stop someone from going into a Tinder account and just fully exporting all of the contact information. Mm-hmm. You know, Tinder is you know, known as a dating site, you know, with you know, various reputations attached to that. But there's quite a bit of personal information that links to, you know, other human beings in that information. And Tinder has the ability to export all of that that information. You know, so protecting not just the person who has that account, but the people that they interact with is something that is seen as very important.
Why only in California right now?
California represents a really significant user base that is, you know, easily testable and has rules on a state level that make it so that, you know, protecting their users, you know, doesn't run afoul of any of the kind of data privacy things that California is currently trying to implement. California is also one of the places where Tinder has a physical office, so they can work with local regulators to make sure that this is, you know, kind of passing the smell test for them.
Now, the facial recognition technology to basically open the Tinder app, is it the same that opens my phone or that opens the app that's for my credit card?
Tinder's actually working with a third-party company called FaceTech, TEC, in order to, you know, store and secure the biometric data. So, you know, your face data isn't going to live on your phone in the same way that it would if you own an iPhone. It is something that will be stored somewhere else and used as a verification. So FaceTech as a company doesn't have any giant, you know, history of data breaches or anything like that. They're you know, well rated as far as security companies go. But this is very much a third party that is storing this information online. And, you know, given the popularity of Tinder, does, you know, run the risk of being a potential security target.
And they feel that the facial recognition is the safest way rather than, I don't know, making you change your password more often or something, or other technology. I mean, other safety things. Yeah.
There are certainly more secure things that can be done. Unfortunately, we live in a world where convenience and security are often at cross purposes. And yeah. If it takes a long time to secure your profile and maintain its security, then fewer people will use it.
Right.
So this is kind of the compromise position.
All right. Your face is easier than changing your password every other day, right?
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Okay. We have about 2 minutes left, and I wanted to get any updates on the CNET tariff tracker, especially after Amazon Days has passed. So how are things going on the tariff tracker?
I wouldn't call it great. a lot of the things that we saw during Prime Day was prices that were, you know, decreased, but not even to the point where they were back in January for a lot of prices. So the things that were seen as sales, you know, were you know, pretty minor discounts, relatively speaking, for a lot of products, especially things like batteries and you know, kind of those everyday essentials. And what we saw after Prime Day, pretty much exactly at midnight when that event ended, was those prices returned to what we hoped were, kind of artificial inflation points, where those prices were artificially raised so that when they lowered, it seemed like they were on sale. That didn't happen in as many places as we had hoped. And in fact, a lot of those prices for those products remained at those high points.
Okay. So what is something that is surprisingly like that it jumped back up in price to you? Is there any sort of thing that surprised you?
AA batteries as kind of a bizarre home staple is a thing that the price of which, I don't certainly think about particularly often, but in tracking this over the last couple of months, it has been really surprising to see that in some cases you're paying as much as 30% more than you were back in December.
And how about things like the Nintendo Switch 2 or an Xbox? Are those maintaining price?
Microsoft announced a price hike to the Xbox by $100 a couple of months ago, and that has remained. It is still $100 more than it was, back in December. Nintendo has not made that same price increase, and neither has Sony at the moment. So the PlayStation and the Nintendo Switch still remain at the announced price, and in some cases have been on sales over the last couple of months that have lowered it even further. But Microsoft being the only American company of the three has chosen to raise its prices by $100, and that has remained the same.
This has been Tech Tuesday on All Sides. We've been speaking with Russell Hawley, the Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Thanks for joining us today, Russell.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks for listening today. This is Tech Tuesday, and this is 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.